When I met you last, you gave me a book called More Absence, Stories on, what was the title of it?
More Stories on Absence.
More Stories on Absence, which I read.
Great.
And that was one of your Google hits. Anyway, I thought maybe we could start by talking about it. Can you tell me about that project?
Yeah. Basically, I could explain already why it's called More Stories on Absence, because it was, again, an insert of a larger scale research I've been doing for the last... let's say 5 years, which is basically dealing with, this sounds really broad, but it's dealing with the creation of iconography and the sort of ending of it. And it has a sort of critical aspect to how obsessed someone could be with his own, you know, presence and his own sort of appearance. In relation to a certain system that this person, in this case, it's art context, tries to question himself or herself.
Could you explain a little bit more what you mean about creation of iconography and end of iconography?
Yeah, the thing is that I don't want to already fall in that trap.
You don't
want to
give away
that.
Your secrets?
No, I do. But the thing is that if I already say creation of iconography, I'm like, oh God, it's
but
so
I
huge.
But you're talking about personal iconography, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that there's this point where I'm kind of interested in this. First of all, okay, I have to actually go through the whole steps of these things.
We have half an hour.
I know. So, I mean, there are different ways in which I try to, highlight this sort of research in which I deal with fictional and non-fictional aspects. And this is all related to the certain system of art and the inner-outer kind of thing. So, it's actually about the creation mythology and the sort of masturbation of your own presence, and then together, dealing with the fact that you're absencing yourself, which is actually making yourself present even more. So what I mean with iconography in that sense is that I'm dealing with personas that are really kind of obsessed with themselves or obsessed with their position, and create, for example, an alter ego. In which they, of course, because you can ask yourself, why do you actually create an alter ego? And that's just, to question your own position you're in the system, in a certain system that you're at. And you, try to research that, or, you create a different kind of person. I don't even know what alter ego could mean, but, a new character that can highlight your position, because you're sort of critical towards it. And then, once this sort of, what I also explained a little bit in the text, once this sort of alter ego is revealed that it was fake, there is this sort of new legend or story that's being created. And that's not even that, it's not for me not even that interesting that, when it's revealed, when it dies or whatever, because for me it's more about, creating a bigger platform for you to function in. So this is one little aspect, which is more...
Can I ask you just so we can be specific. So can you talk about how that relates to Warhol and J.T. Lewoy, who are both subjects in this book, or both discussed?
Yeah. Well, Warhol?
Yeah, talk about Warhol.
Warhol in this case is, I actually had to start with Duchamp, because Duchamp was one of my first big sort of encounters, I think everybody was, but for me it was more related with his positioning as Richard Mouton Rose Lafay. I was really really obsessed with more the presence of Duchamp himself and the attitude he positioned himself with in art than rather what he sort of, all the objects, all the things that he presented were just, a side effect of his intelligence. And Richard Mouton Rose Lafay, and in the end also playing chess was so dear to, so personal to himself. And I was really kind of interested in this starting of someone that was dealing with a lot of role playing, especially in the context of art, which was not happening that much at all. And just questioning himself as an artist, which is just basic questions. But I mean, that was at the start. So, and that was he did that already at the beginning of his career, let's say. And then there was this ending of his career that you would call ending, you know, quote unquote, in which he said, you know, I think that chess playing is much more interesting. I just stopped painting. But that was more as a statement. All his things were more towards a statement. So Duchamp is a really important part. And I thought that in relation to Warhol, which is, of course, a person that is all about a personality and an environment, and the whole thing around him is all about him, basically. I thought that the combination between these two, I mean, I showed Andy Warhol's screen test of Duchamp, and I thought that was so amazing piece of, like, two icons observing each other, like, one more in the framework of Warhol, you know, his way of dealing with art, and then a person that was like the godfather of Warhol, like observing each other. It was like giving away the roles. And they're both constantly like playing with, you know, with the questioning of personality, etc. So that was for me really important to have like really big icons. Like, you know, that's what everybody's talking about. And it's just interesting to have that as a starting point and go into, like, let's say the macro, which is not so macro, into the micro, which is maybe macro in another, not a context, but micro in the context of art, like a J.T. Leroy. So I'm kind of also a lot of interested in cases which are not immediately art related, but I think they are in the setting that they're people that are on the border of their field. Let's say like someone like J.T. Leroy or Andy Kaufman or Alan Abel. These are three people that I've been working with a lot, which are all not, you know, not they're performance artists, but Anikava was a stand-up comedian, but it's so on the border between a performative artist within the, you know, context of art or in the context of theater. It's like this constant questioning, which he plays really smart. And it's the same thing with Alan Abel, and they're both not shown in contemporary art. And that's with J.T. Leroy. I mean, this is again the build-up of three sort of historical characters through different periods of time. So like Alan Abel starts in the 50s as a godfather of Kaufman being obsessed with Alan Abel, takes it a bit further, but actually reflects more on himself. I mean, it's all like self-absorption, huh?
And then can I ask you a question? So I'm also, you know, interested in the subject of alter ego, and it's really a huge topic, and I kind of want to understand more where you're coming from with it. I curated a show that was called Alter Ego, boringly, and it looked at, you know, basically how people can use their alter egos to exist in the world in a kind of different way, and it also looked at, you know, how alter egos amplified kind of anxieties or embodied fantasies or whatever. Mm-hmm. But I'm just, so it was kind of looked more also at the people themselves, right, and the conditions that were creating alter egos. But I'm sort of curious, you know, are you interested in just the kind of like half-life of an alter ego itself in terms of like legend and fame making, or are you more interested in the original persona like Alan Abel or Andy Kaufman or the people that are creating these alter egos? Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, but I'm interested in both, because I don't think that one or the other can live without. I mean, there, you have to look into a really personal level of this person, and then go into how, you know, the mind has developed itself. The thing is that, you know, alter ego for me is not really a good word. I just always wanted to have this ambiguous relation between, you know, I'm not interested if it's fictional or non-fictional. Mm-hmm. For me, it's more about, you know, the sort of platform that I create. It's not about like a side identity. It's just, mm-hmm. you know, some of these people, it took over their whole lives, and it created this whole new world for them, which is very interesting. I mean, there are a lot of people that play with little alter ego pranks and stuff, but it's everybody's obsessed with looking at themselves or going into the world with a new identity and see how, you know, people respond to that. But for me, it was also, I don't want to go into a little bit like, but there were like really specific interests in these people because of my background, since I've been it's maybe important to say that I was working in theater and I developed myself so and through that in visual arts. So I always had this interest. That's why I also always keep it for myself open, not being like an artist or a curator or whatever, but just trying to have this sort of platform to work for myself.
So one more question about your background. So you're Dutch.
Yeah.
So, but you're interested in sort of more, it seems like generally American icons, is that correct? In this book at least. I'm wondering, like, what is the fascination with American pop culture?
Well, it's not that it's immediately America. It's at this point, yes. I think that it's especially the society of and then the whole scale of America that can create these sort of figures. I don't think that there is, you know, like for example, a person like Alan Abel is someone that grew with the power of the media, and there's no country in the world where the power of the media is this big as America. I mean, the industry is clearly here, and you can, you know, if you play it smart, you can really get into a big power game. So America is absolutely the most interesting place for that. I mean, look at Wall. I mean, all these people couldn't have existed if they were just living in the Netherlands. You know, it was just about that power structure, which is so heavily dominated in this country. So it's not, I mean, it's at this point that I'm interested in these figures. But, you know, like, for example, in the show More Stories Than Absent, there are also other people involved. But you're right that they're absolutely, you know, that America is the bigger part. But, I mean, I'm at this point working on a show, which actually I was wondering, like, because there are about these three figures that I'm relating a lot to, like, you know, beginning with Alan Abel, going to Andy Kaufman, ending with J.T. Leroy. And always people said, like, why these three? Because I think that all three of them grew in the media. They were obsessed with the sort of media, you know, media attention or playing with media in a very intelligent way. And they're in different periods in time. So for me, it's very interesting. And I actually, you know, also was thinking about, you know, around the title of America. It's like, you know, going into sort of American abstraction through three, you know, really case-based studies, you know, very specific.
So do you find yourself, you know, I share this fascination with people like Andy Kaufman and Warhol. I worked in his archive for 2 years. And J.T. Leroy and other sort of media figures like comedians like Richard Pryor, people like that. But I'm curious what you think about video artists who do interventions into popular culture. Do you find, like Matthew Laurette or something like that? Do you find that as interesting, or is it more these people who are really? Because that in itself is a real practice, you know.
I'm not so much interested in that. People like Matthew Laurette, etc. It's too. Although it's in their practice and their fascination, it's not from real enough for me. It's not from the heart. It's not, you know, I mean, all three of these characters don't give a shit about contemporary art. I mean, someone like Matthew Rapp is someone that clearly was, you know, dealing with strategies, how he could, you know, infiltrate himself in the art market and play with it in a very smart way in relationship to pop culture, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But it's all in this little framework of the art world. And for me, that's absolutely, in this context, not interesting. It's interesting as part of, you know, like for example, Duchamp or whatever, or Wall. Of course, they played with that as well a lot. But in like these Andy Kaufman, Alan Abel, and J.T. Leroy persons, they are not in contemporary art at all. But I think that they're necessary to be shown in contemporary art. So there's a whole body of work which you just have to like actually give more a body to make it visual, to like consume it in the art context. But I do think it's really important. Like if you would put a Matthew Laurette in between these people, it would look like a joke what Matthew does, because it's just, you know, it's so small in that context.
So how do you, you work as both an artist and a curator, but in both of those practices, like you say, you're going outside of the contemporary art world a little bit. So I'm curious, do you see the contemporary art world as a sort of bounded entity? Are you the kind of curator who's you know, going to see galleries in Chelsea only, or is that as an artist where you want to show, or you obviously, you know, where does your inspiration come from mainly? Is it that space or outside?
Well,
or?
I mean, I'm not trying to like, I'm clearly an institutional boy, and I'm very happy in the context of art. So I'm not trying to like say like, oh, I'm looking outside of the art boundaries and show that. I'm just really specific in my research, and I'm as a curator and as an artist, I always deal with the. Maybe it sounds boring, but I have such a big topic and there's so many aspects to explore, that as curator or as artist or as writer or whatever, I only deal with a very specific. Again, kind of topic which deals with, you know, theorizing performativity, basically. I'm not interested in the immediate performance. I'm interested in performativity and where it comes from and how it develops itself. That's why it's also important to say that this is like a little point of this larger scale research, which has to do a lot with, you know, absence, basically. Mm-hmm. I mean, almost all my work deals with a form of absence. I mean, it sounds maybe a bit, you know, redundant or something, but like, for example, a large project I've been doing, Archiving Disappearance, which deals with artists that withdrew from artistic production, is a really, really large project. But that's the other side, you know, flip side of the coin. That's actually people that are just, there's a genuine reason. There's no fictional aspect to this. There's no, I mean, the other one also have a genuine reason, but this is something like real, you know. You know, just people that say like, you know, the art world is the art world. I was an artist. I'm just more interested in being a baker now. But, you know, in this context of the arts, it's not that simple to flip like that, you know? And then I question myself, why? How, you know, what are these reasons? How does it develop, you know? So that's why I'm sort of setting up this archive of a lot of cases which I'm studying.
Yeah, can we talk about that?
Yeah, of course. The thing is that the whole project is one big paradox. I cannot avoid it.
I think that's healthy.
It's very consuming. It's very, I mean, I bounce and bounce and bounce against millions of walls and get bored with myself. I get bored with the research and get obsessed with the research and, you know, lay it for a month or two somewhere. I mean, the problem with the project is that it's basically people that withdrew from the art context, which is very sexy for the art context. You could see it as a, it's not even, but you could, it could be seen as a radical gesture. And it's just, you know, it's just people like me that love these sort of, you know, institution, it's not even institution, yeah, it's institutional radicality, and then, you know, try to consume it and try to actually discuss it in this system that these people withdrew from, which is not respectful, and it's totally paradoxical. Yeah, it's kind of the reason. So I have to explain why I'm actually doing this, because I mean, if you already have this, you know, as a starting point, why do it? Well, because I think I'm really specific doing researching cases which I think are extraordinary. I mean, there are quite a lot of people that withdraw. There are a lot of people that withdraw and turn back, because there's nothing more tempting that, you know, you withdraw. A lot of people withdraw because they just had like 2-3 years of attention and nobody gave it them anymore, and they're like, okay. And then there's like 10 years later, there's a young curator knocking on the door because he found this little fantastic work in a box somewhere. And then everybody returns back and shows again, you know. That's not interesting. I just thought it was interesting to show cases which were really extraordinary, but were because of their withdrawal, boxed in and forgotten, quote unquote forgotten, like not really, but like it's because especially we're talking about a withdrawal from a successful perspective, a successful position, people that are in the market, a market that has invested in them, so curatorial wise, so people, you know, promoting their work. Collection-wise, people buying it, galleries, etc., promoting it. There's a whole investment. So there's both ways, you know, there, you and your body of work, and then there's the whole, you know, market around it, the ones to consume it. So you say that at market, fuck you, I'm done, goodbye. And the market says, okay, but we invested all this money in you, you know. So what happens is that everybody says, fuck, you know, okay, then fuck the work. And the work is boxed in and goes away.
Okay, I'm dying for an example.
Okay. So the most significant example is Lee Lozano,
right.
And she is at this point consumed as an idiot. I mean, she basically was a painter in the late during the course of the 60s, with very interesting work. She was doing fine. I mean, she had a gallery, she sold, etc. She was in New York. She was kind of already a known person. But during her work, you see that her mind becomes more radical, and she sees all of a sudden her texts as paintings, etc. And then she, in the end, like late 60s, she starts to do the language pieces, which are text-driven works in which she gives herself instructions from not going to any, withdrawing herself from certain shows to not talking to women anymore, et cetera, et cetera. She gives herself, during a course of 2 years, 50 instructions, which blend into another. And they go really into small little investigations, like, what would I do if I masturbate myself with this carrot? What would I do? You know, and she just writes it down
not
in a diary.
Not talking to women anymore?
Yeah. And what she does, so she has all these structures, instructions, and she gives them names, like, for example, the boycott women piece, the withdrawal piece, the party piece, in which she, for example, went to a party and told a successful but failing artist at that point her best idea and see if he would copy it. You know, all these little kind of social, mental kind of things. And she, well, basically she did one really big piece called the Wave Series, which is paintings. And then she disappeared for 10 years. Nobody knew where she was. She just disappeared. And then when two collectors, gallerists, were interested in showing her work, they found her mentally disturbed in Dallas. And
when you say mentally disturbed, was she living independently?
She was living with her parents. She was, making her parents go crazy. I mean, she was really, her mind was really fucked up, basically. And the interesting thing about it, her whole career is that, okay, anyway, they wanted to sell her work and they sold her work, etc., etc. But I mean, she's like, I don't want to have anything to do with it, but here you go, sell it. You know, she withdrew from the whole art context, etc. But people, and then she told her brother, this is my best piece ever. It's called the Dropout piece. And she also wrote in her diary that was the hardest piece she would have done. So how the art world consumes it now is that the 10 years she left, there are lots of different stories around it. Or the 10 years she left and disappeared, it's called a dropout piece. Or the whole years up till she died in 1999, it's called a dropout piece. Or it's basically she withdrawing and the art world not accepting, also in relation to her earlier work, that was actually also a piece, the whole 20 years. So then you really have the question of when you're actually in life, or art and life, or whatever kind of thing, you know, the Ellen Capo question. And, you know, so she's a very interesting figure that, interestingly enough.
So how do you archive her?
So she, like I basically have all her books and images, et cetera, et cetera. But I have it for myself. I'm not, the archive is maybe interesting to say that the archive of Archiving Disappearance is a mental archive, an archive that I develop, which are cases which I've been presenting already the last 1.5 years through lectures in different institutions through Europe or the world, whatever. So I give these lectures, and what I do in these lectures are very practical. I start talking about the archive, how I structure the archive, because it was very important for me to give certain structure to the research, and like reasons for withdrawal, and then all the cases I found I put into these sections. 5 sections of withdrawal, I just would call them. Mm-hmm. So explain each section and give for each section an example, and explain the whole body of work. Go through the whole body of work, explaining how it developed itself and what the reason was for withdrawal, et cetera, et cetera. So it's really practical lectures. I mean, they're almost performances, you know, they're really very practical. And that's the only time when the archive is basically there. So I give a lecture to you, and then, you know, you, which cases you thought were extraordinary, you archive for yourself. Why I do that is because I want to minimalize as much as possible the material from the people that withdrew from a system that they're not happy in. So what you get is artists that are obsessed with this, taking it back into the system of art and showing it, look at her, and she withdrew. You know, it's a paradox, it's disrespectful. Mm-hmm. And I'm more interested in the storytelling, how these myths, you know, it's sort of like a mythology around the whole thing. Maybe that's also not very good, but I really like the aspect of the of speech in this context, so that there's a lot of, you know, what I've been doing is symposia around it, and I ask people to talk about their, you know, research within this topic, or present a case, you know, et cetera, et cetera. So that's actually how the project lives. I think that that's kind of important.
So I see what you're saying about a paradox, because you're just, so you feel like your participation can be somewhat of a paradox because you're bringing them back in, but you try to fight, you sort of try to deal with that by just making it about fleeting kind of stories and stuff like that. Is that right?
Just like, I think why I actually did this, because I just felt these people like Lilo Zano, like Laurie Parsons, like Toting Chi, like Katie Nolan, like, you know, they're just extraordinary figures that, I mean, Katie Nolan, okay, but the other ones were less known. And whenever I present their body, everybody's like, wow, it's extraordinary. And it's just about, you know, exploiting all these ideas that this was there. It's great, you know. It's very simple. So I just want to sort of, you know, educate
people around it. It's interesting that success is a prerequisite for the artists that you look at, right? Because you wouldn't look at artists who weren't successful and withdrew.
Exactly, because, there are tons of that. I mean, that's extremely uninteresting, because that's not, how can you drop out if you're not even in, you know? How can you, that's impossible. And then, of course, there's a question of what kind of success, what is the ladder of success? I mean, having a show at MoMA or having a gallery, you know, what is this, I mean, there's a lot of questions in this. And it's, and there's also, you know, and then again, to come back to the performativity aspect of this, is that I actually like, that the act of dropping out as a performative act, basically, and it's not a performative act, but that you approach it in a sort of in that way, that you just that actually then you can discuss it. So yeah, that's like the flip side of someone that's playing like with an alter ego and is questioning himself, and actually when the alter ego sort of gets revealed, you know, what happened with J.T. Leroy, what happened with, you know, whatever, Rosa Lavie, what happened with, you know, once it gets, when, you know, public that it was fake, there is this whole burst of legends and stories around it, which is crazy, which is fascinating. But it's a different kind of thing. But you see what I mean with the sort of relationship between the borders of that. So there's a whole blur of webs between my research that all are interconnecting, but yeah.
Yeah. There you go. And so is your art then, it's speech and research and performance based, you don't make objects? Or do you?
I wouldn't.
What does your art consist of? Is your art in
No, I mean, you're right on that. It's just that, you know, I do my research in specific kind of topics, like, whatever, and then I decide if it works better as a curatorial project in which I want to work with artists around it, or if it needs to be a lecture, or it needs to be a film, or it needs to be a performance, or it could also be an object, actually. You know, I don't think I've ever done it, but, you know, it's possible.
Yeah. So why can't you just be a curator?
The thing is that it's kind of really, for me, very important that I leave this field open so I can just present. I mean, sometimes it's just not, this research is not possible to present in a curatorial aspect. It's just, you know, I want to do much more with this information and just present it as it is. You know, I just want to give it a body. So I'm not even sure if that is an artist
or
a curator.
Why do you have to separate that from being?
I'm not separating any of my curatorial or artistic practice. It's one big thing. It's not like, oh, now you see Chris as an artist, now you see Chris as a curator. It's, I mean, if you see...
But that's, I guess that's my question for you, is that it does seem like very much the same.
Yeah, it is. And I try to keep it open, and then, like, of course you have the question, why not just be a curator and be a bit more, you know, just... So, well, whatever. I mean, if you're happy to call me like that, I will be a curator for you. I just want to keep it really open for myself. You know, so it's just that there's a really fine line between when you how far you can go as a curator within your exhibition making or project making. You know, when you have all this information, like a person of Andy Kaufman, you know, is it interesting to show all these texts which nobody's going to read, or do you want to give a sort of body to it to it's more easy to consume? How, for me, that's very interesting questions. And how do you, how?
Wait, can you reiterate that? Sorry, I didn't hear you. Totally.
Okay.
Ask that again.
How can you?
Half an hour's up.
You and your time.
No, we keep going.
No, for me, it's just interesting how. Sometimes you have a lot of information which you really want people to, you know, understand in your exhibition making, but it's not made by an artist. It's made by an artist, but it's not art, or it's not immediately something that this person did, you know, something that's being created by different people in relation to what this person did.
Yeah,
see what
yeah,
I mean?
Yeah.
God. Anyway, sometimes it's just better to give you have all this information, but an exhibition is also about consuming information. And how can you make this information not as easy, but as most accessible? And then there comes a point when, well, maybe I have to make, I have to use some actors to make it a little bit more, you know, be a little bit more free with this. But you can also go across the line and then it becomes like, you know, an artist that uses other artists' works to like show his whole world, which is, you know, the horrible side. So mm-hmm. There's a really thin line that, you know, that I try not to cross, which so far I haven't, but, you know.
I think it's interesting to me that you're drawn to projects that require some kind of, like, belief or, I mean, all I guess all things require audience, but this kind of maybe mass attention or something like that. Like, you know, with the dropout artists, there is a mystique around them, and there is a kind of, their stories have to be articulated in a certain way for them to be comprehensible, right? But, you know, the story that you may tell about Lee Lozano is, in a way, ultimately conjecture. You know, she went insane. You know, you don't really know what, like, the logic base there was for it, you know, but you are recounting it. But anyway, and then you're also interested, you know, in Kaufman and Warhol and these artists who have kind of mass followings. It's sort of interesting to me. And I'm thinking about your background as in theater and maybe wondering how someone who is in theater makes the jump to being a curator, an artist who's interested in performativity with this kind of, I think, underlying aspect of being interested in how persona and how these things are made.
Yeah.
You know? So I'm just wondering, maybe you could talk a little bit about why you gave up on theater and being an actor.
It was very, very limited. I mean, I was basically, it was so clear, it was so set and ready. I was doing amateur theater. I would go and to cabaret school and I would do my stuff. And I was not interested in, I was not so much interested in, also I already had that feeling, like I'm not interested in going on stage and do my thing and there's an audience. I was already on that early age bored with that. But the moment when I was doing this which is basic, you know, small little exercises, I felt so limited. Theater can be so, and also what I really hated is when I always went to a theater play I would sit in the audience, and the first half to half hour to an hour, if I was lucky, if there were good actors, I would not believe it. And then later on, you know, because you are getting sucked in, you know, it could be good theater. I mean, of course, I mean, I've seen really good ones, and still at the beginning, I'm like, always have to adjust because it's such an artificial environment. And the aspect of visual art just gave me such unbelievable broad horizon of working in. I mean, you can act, I could do everything.
But it's interesting because you bring this, you were surrounded by people who wanted to be famous and by fame, right, mm-hmm. in theater. And then you brought this sort of interest in fame into the visual arts, right? Or maybe you don't see it that way.
It's not immediately, I think fame is a bit...
You don't like that, it's too crude.
No, because, I mean, it's...
I think I'm sort of psychoanalyzing
I know what you mean, but it's not even fame, because it's not about fame in a direct way, because all of these people are indirectly obsessed with fame, but they try to deal with it in a very, very intelligent way. So a person like Alan Abel is someone that was, like, invisible in the media, but he was so visible. I mean, he's done tons and tons from the 50s up to now, tons and tons of media hoaxes, he made himself invisible, but he's clearly obsessed with fame.
Yeah.
By, you know, making himself invisible, you know? That's a whole different way. It's the same with Annie Kaufman playing a lot with the ambiguous relationship. Is he real or what is he doing here? Is he really making a really bad talk show? Is he, you know, and how far does he push this? So it's more how you consume fame than wanting to be famous.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So that's something different.
Yeah.
And I don't know about the word. I mean, fame is, I immediately have this pop feeling with it.
Yeah.
You could tell.
I see what you mean.
It's like more like self-absorption or something.
Do you want to talk about your show at Lux?
Yeah. You didn't see it?
I saw it.
Really?
Yeah.
Did it work?
For about 2 seconds. Yeah, it worked.
Where was I?
What do you mean, where were you?
2 seconds you left?
You were there the whole time?
When was this?
Last week.
When, for the opening?
For the opening I was there for like a minute.
When you left?
With my mom, yeah.
Okay. Basically, that is exactly what I mean with giving a body to a text. The critique I got is, why not just make a book? I'm like, okay, and there's a book again, and there's a pile of books again, and it's there. But how do I make an exhibition? Because this is, again, an insert of a larger exhibition I'm making at several locations, but the first one will be in Belgrade, Contemporary Art Museum, in which I want to spread this sort of information on relationship between J.T. Leroy, Andy Kaufman, and Alan Abel. I couldn't say the names even more. Anyway, basically, this is a little insert called Laura, which is about the persona that created J.T. Leroy, Laura Albert. And Laura Albert gave an exclusive interview with the Paris Review about her life, basically her whole background from when she was a child up to the point when she encountered J.T. Leroy. And my first encounter with J.T. Leroy, so this is also a personal story, is January 2004, where the Dutch television did an interview with him, or it, whatever, her. And I was so extremely fascinated by this interview that I started reading all the books and I got really into it, and I followed the story, and then it got revealed that it was, you know, fake, etc., etc. And I was really following this already from that start, so basically for 2.5 years now, 3 years. So I was interested in like this unfolding of a brain of this sort of master brain. So basically, so it's Laura, so the three storylines. There's Laura, which talks about her personal life, and her personal background is really already, you know, kind of unbelievable. I mean, she was clearly already obsessed with boys and creating different characters and different voices and different situations from early on. So it's not like she just all of a sudden decided to do J.T. Leroy. She'd been doing that already like for a long time. Then there is the interview with the very insecure J.T. Leroy person. And then there is inserts of the book, which is basically Laura in the body of J.T. Lee. So that's a third layer of a brain, let's say. So what I did is made a double slide projection piece, which were across from each other. The left one projects just black images with subtitles, and the subtitles just go from, you know, the point where she was born, etc. She refers to these places like she was born there and there and there, and I went to visit these places and made photographs of them now. In a very abstract way, not that I went to her room, but I just went to like a building that she's referring to, like public housing in Brooklyn Heights. So I just go to Brooklyn Heights, I find an image of a public house, and I make a photograph of that. Or she says San Francisco, I go to San Francisco and I make a photo of the skyline. She refers to Virginia, I make a photo in Virginia. You know, it's very simple. So it's like to get it out of the storytelling. So that's that part, and then there's that's constantly in the loop. And then the other, the one in the back, is actually constantly black and sometimes has this small little inserts of the interview of Jade Lee Roy. It's set up that when you sit in the middle that you cannot really focus too much on both. It doesn't, you know, you cannot. You just, there's like, you go into this brain that has different kinds of layers. So yeah, this is a really visual way for me. Still, it was very non-visual, but this is how I mean, it was a tryout, I have to be honest. It was a tryout, but it's still a tryout, but I was already quite happy with it. Although there were, you know, I have to go through the text with some mistakes, etc., that I realized then, but, you know, they're just minor details. What did you think?
Well, hold on, we're wrapping this up. I actually really liked it.
Yeah?
Yeah. How long are you going to be in New York for?
I'm leaving on Saturday.
Are you going to be happy to leave?
I'll be coming back because I'm doing some events this year and next year. How was the time? It was great. It was just, but the thing is that I was just here for 3 months and I've been like running like an idiot because I said I'm not here to like be in New York and live in New York. I'm here to work in New York. So I'm just, you know, just here to meet and work with as much as interesting people as possible and, you know, set stuff. It was really basically, you know, it was a long business trip. I mean, you could call it like that. So 3 months was fine, but, you know, I'm happy to go back because I have a lot of other stuff, to do, but I'm, you know, it's great that, you know, now I can go back a little bit more.
And where do you live?
Amsterdam.